Welcome to Footnotes for Faith, where each week we take a few minutes to expand our understanding of the Christian faith, connect Scripture to life, and consider the claims of Jesus. I'm your host, Scott Fisher, pastor at Delaware Valley Christian Church in Media, Pennsylvania, which, as I always say, is just outside the awesome and great city of Philadelphia. And I had the wonderful experience last night of attending a Sixers playoff game with my son-in-law, Luke, who got me a free ticket through his company, and we had an awesome time. And so I love the city of Philadelphia. I love its history. I love its sports. And we're glad to greet you for this podcast from just outside the great city of Philadelphia. I wanted to start the podcast today by reading a few notes that have come in from listeners, and I always appreciate getting feedback from listeners and people sharing what they have found helpful on the podcast or suggestions or areas that they would like to get more deeply into. So I want to encourage you. Part of the reason I read these is because I want to encourage you to write in, and it helps us as we prepare the podcast. So here's a couple little snippets from some notes I've received recently. So one listener wrote in and said, catching up a bit today and just listened to the anxiety podcast. It's really, really good. Think I'm going to bookmark it and pull it out in difficult moments when I'm fighting despair. So that's an encouraging note, and glad that that was helpful for this listener. And it's a great idea. The great thing about a podcast, especially if it's not a real long one like these are usually about 15 to 20 minutes long, you can always go back and listen to it again, and parts of it that you found helpful, you can go back to and listen to in times where you need them. Somebody else wrote and said, I just listened to the latest episode of Footnotes for Faith on when prayers go unanswered. I love the podcast. I always look forward to listening every week. This week's episode really hit home for me for a couple reasons. Not many people understand the confusion and stress that my challenges give me, but I take comfort in knowing that Jesus understands. Thank you for your well-timed episode. Well, you're welcome to this listener, and you're right. Jesus does understand, and as we talked about the issue of unanswered prayers, one of our takeaways was that we know that Christ does understand us when we are in those deep moments, because he himself experienced those moments as he took on human form and live this life, so he could fully embrace the life that we live. So glad it was helpful. And then I'll just read one more. Somebody wrote and said, we just listened to our first ever Footnotes for Faith podcast on politics and religion. And they said, thank you, Pastor Scott, for your insights, historical reminiscences, and pastoral care risk-taking. So that was an encouraging note as well. So anyway, I read those just to give you a sample of what the feedback that we're getting. And again, if you have them, take a few moments and just give us some feedback as well, we'd appreciate it. And so this week, I'm going to return to some topics that are a topic that we've sort of started talking about a little bit earlier, and I'm going to sprinkle it throughout our podcast episodes. And that has to do with Scripture and the confidence that we can have, or why we have confidence in Scripture. But I'm going to start with something I experienced, or our family experienced, when we were living overseas in South America in a developing country doing mission work a number of years ago. And growing up, I didn't grow up on a farm. I didn't grow up in an agricultural type setting. Grew up in the typical suburban neighborhood. And for me, buying chicken or having my mom buy chicken at the store was something. You went in, you went to the meat aisle, you found your pieces of chicken breast, chicken legs, whatever, nicely, neatly wrapped in cellophane. You bring it home, you cook it. Well, when we lived in South America, in the developing country, that's not how we bought chicken. My kids learned to pedal our bikes down to the local meat market. And when you go to the meat market, you can literally pick out a live chicken. They basically kill the chicken right there. They pluck the chicken, and they put it in a bag, and you bring it home. Can't get it any fresher than that. Well, that gives you insight into there's a whole process that goes into getting chicken. So I'm sure for a lot of kids today, and you know, they think that chicken just comes cellophane wrapped and plastic from the store, but there's a whole process. So you say, well, you know, what does that have to do with the Bible? Well, the reason I brought that up is because in many ways, I think the way that we experience the Bible today in our world is much like the difference between buying chicken in a store where it's already cellophane wrapped and the whole process is, we're at the end of that process, and with the way the Bible comes to us, because today we have these nicely bound, indexed, versed Bibles where we have 66 writings of the Bible nicely bound, and we can look up pages, we can look up verses, and it's all right there for us. But it can kind of blind us to the reality that that's not how the Bible was originally came about. That's the end of a very long process of gathering. The Bible, of course, was written, and the Bible, as we looked at earlier, simply means book. That's what the word Bible means, or the book, or the Holy Bible is the holy book, is a collection of many writings over thousands of years, written on stone, written on scrolls, written on parchment, circulated around to people in many different areas and countries and parts of the world and churches. So it's only been with the invention of the printing press in the Middle Ages that we began to have printed copies of the Bible that were bound in one volume. And of course, now we have the privilege of having digital copies of the Bible. So we live in a very privileged age to have the Bible bound together like it is. But we need to realize that that's not how the Bible came to us originally, but we have that advantage of having this process. And so the reason I bring that up is because sometimes you'll hear or you'll see in the popular media claims, lost books of the Bible found, or secret gospels discovered. The success of Dan Brown's fictional series on the Da Vinci Code has fed into a lot of ideas that there's these esoteric books of the Bible that have been hidden for centuries or millennia and now have just recently been found, and if believed, they would overthrow everything we know about Scripture. And the reality is that that's really not accurate. Of course, Dan Brown was writing fiction. Some people forget that. But the question is raised, well, how did we get the Bible that we have today in terms of the particular set of books and the writings? How do we know that those writings in the Bible are the right ones? How do we know that? How do we know there aren't authoritative writings that weren't included that are floating around out there? Why do Roman Catholic Bibles have additional books in the Old Testament that the Protestants don't? So if you pick up a Roman Catholic, official Roman Catholic version of the Bible, and you look in the Old Testament, you'll see that there are about 13 to 15 additional books that the Protestant Bibles don't have. Why is that? How did it all come about? Did they have meetings and vote? Some people picture it like they had these meetings and they all voted and they said, all right, how many people think Matthew should be in the Bible? All right, let's see a show of hands. That's not how it happened, but some people think that. Was it a political process? So I want to encourage you, as you listen to this podcast, if you haven't listened to the earlier podcasts, one on can we trust our Bibles and another one on translations, I would encourage you to listen to, because those kind of go along with this particular topic and they'd be good to listen to. But so today we're going to talk for a few minutes about what is called the canon. Now, this is not a canon like a cannon you shoot cannonballs out of. This is a canon, C-A-N-O-N, not C-A-N-N-O-N. And the word canon, you may have heard that word, actually comes from a Hebrew or Greek word that means, originally meant a cane or a measuring rod. In other words, it was something that measured something that held something up to a certain standard. And it became a meaning that Christians used for a norm or a rule of faith. And so from history, the church fathers of the 4th century AD first used this term to refer to a definitive authoritative body of sacred scripture. So when we talk about the canon, we're talking about what books of the Bible were accepted or recognized to be the books that should be included as authoritative, as scripture, as books that were given by God. So obviously when we start thinking about that, we have 66 books, and I said 13 or 14 more in the Catholic Bibles. So we have, you know, 39 in the old, basically 27 in the new. So we have the Old Covenant and the New Covenant, or the Hebrew Scriptures sometimes, as Jewish people would refer to them, the Hebrew Scriptures, or we refer to them as the Old Testament or the Old Covenant. So how did these come about? Well, we're just going to do a survey of this today. It's a very interesting topic. I would encourage you again, I've mentioned this book before, and I will rely on this book for some information today, called Can We Still Believe the Bible by Craig L. Blomberg. You can get it from Amazon. It's a great book. You can read much more in depth than I'm going to go into today. And as I've said on this podcast before, and you're probably sick of hearing it, that my goal in this podcast is to introduce you to some things and let you do more research, but at least touch on these things that are important for us to know. But anyway, all that to say, by the time Jesus came along, the Hebrew Scriptures, or again, what we call the Old Testament, was pretty much set in terms of what writings were considered by the Jewish people to be inspired by God or Holy Scripture. It's interesting, when you think about the Gospels, there were a lot of debates between Jesus and the religious leaders, but there really wasn't debate over what was, in fact, the authoritative Scripture. They agreed upon that. And so that the canon, as we might call it, of the Old Testament, the accepted books, were pretty well set. And much of that had to do with who wrote them. For example, Moses is believed to have written the first five books of the Old Testament, called the Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And then we had books written by prophets. And so all of these things went into to the Jewish people accepting that these various books were Scripture. It's interesting that, as Blomberg brings out, no references to competing or unorthodox Hebrew writings from the Old Testament have existed anywhere, as far as we know in history. There's no evidence that there were any rivals for the Old Testament books as we know them today. Now, this is what's interesting. During what's called the intertestamental period, what is that? That's the period between the last book of the Old Testament that we're aware of, which is the book of Malachi, and the beginning of the New Testament era was a time of about 400 years. Some books developed during that time, that 400 period, that are often referred to as the Apocrypha. That comes from a Greek word that means to hide away. In biblical literature, Apocrypha refer to works or writings that were outside of the canon or the accepted books of Scripture. And it usually refers to books that were considered sort of esoteric or secret writings that were at first maybe prized and looked at as giving more information, later tolerated to a degree, and then finally at some point they were excluded as being Scripture. Now, what's interesting about the Apocrypha, and this goes back to why the Roman Catholic Church has 13, 14, 15 additional books in their Old Testament, is that eventually, and it wasn't until the Middle Ages around 1546 that these books were accepted into the Roman Catholic Church as authoritative Scripture. They're also accepted in some of the Eastern Orthodox lists of Bible books. It's interesting, though, that the Apocrypha was never accepted as inspired or authoritative by any branch of Judaism or ever put forward as inspired, and that happened much later. Now, what's interesting is that these books were never officially declared Scripture by the Roman Catholic Church until what was called the Council of Trent, as in 1546. And this was largely a reaction to Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation. And during this Protestant Reformation, Luther, who was a Roman Catholic priest, was calling the church back to its foundations, and he was insisting that Christianity return to the Bible of the Jewish Jesus and the Jewish apostles. And he was calling for the church to return to that, and he was gaining that emphasis from the official accepted writings. And the other thing was, some of the doctrines that Luther was arguing against, that the Roman Catholic Church was teaching, were found in the Apocrypha. And so one of the reactions to that was the Council of Trent, which is when the Roman Catholic Church got together and basically said, okay, we're going to accept these books as Scripture, sort of counter Martin Luther. But this was many years after their original writing. And so Protestants still do not accept those books as being actually Scripture. Now, that's the Old Testament. The New Testament was anticipated by the prophecies of the Old, of course. So why do we have two testaments? Because in the Old Testament, we find prophecies of the Messiah, we find predictions of the future, things that are still God is still going to do, and that is anticipated to be coming at the time that Jesus came. So that's where we get the New Testament scripture. And there's a beautiful symmetry between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant in the sense that we have creation in Genesis, and we have paradise lost in Genesis through the fall of man, and we get to the last book of the Bible, Revelation, and we have paradise restored. So it's a beautiful symmetry we see in the beginning book of the Bible all the way to the ending book of the Bible, the book of Revelation. Blomberg says this, he says, good arguments adopted by a wide swath of liberal and conservative scholars alike date all the books accepted in the New Testament to the first century, or in the case of one or two books, perhaps to the very earliest years of the second century. This is the second century AD, after the time of Jesus. The next oldest Christian writings, the so-called apostolic fathers, which date mostly from the first half of the second century, are all largely orthodox in their doctrine. Only beginning in the second half of the second century does literature begin to arise of a very different kind. The most fanciful and unorthodox documents do not emerge until the third through the fifth century. So what he's basically saying there is the earliest accounts we have of what was accepted as the New Testament books goes very early back to the first century and early second century. And many of these other books that we'll hear about where people will say, well, you know, we discovered this book, we discovered that book, come much later, and actually their teachings are quite different in many areas than what we find in the New Testament. So real quickly, in the time I have left, and I know we're covering a lot of ground here, so this is one of those episodes where you're probably going to have a headache by the end. But there are three basic criteria that Blomberg brings out for what was applied to any book written to determine whether it fit into the canon. And again, it wasn't like they voted about it. It was sort of an organic process by which the church received or recognized that which was scripture. And the first one had to do with what's called apostolicity. What does that mean? That means, was the book written by an apostle, that would be one of the 12 original followers of Jesus, or was it written during the age when those apostles were around before the last apostle died, and that would be the apostle John? So, for example, in the terms of the Gospels, Matthew and John, two of the Gospels, they were both apostles, they were both companions of Jesus, they witnessed these things firsthand. Mark was a companion of both the Apostle Peter and the Apostle Paul, so he received his information directly from them. And Luke, who wrote the Gospel of Luke, was a ministry companion of Paul, and he interviewed eyewitnesses, as he says in Luke 1. So no one, the four Gospels have never really been debated in church history as far as being authentic accounts and definitive, authoritative accounts of the life of Jesus. So the first thing is, when were these books written? Were they written by an apostle, or during the times of the apostles, where the apostles could also receive them? The second test was universality. That means that these were books that were spread among many Christian groups. It wasn't just one group in the corner somewhere that had this book and claimed it to be scripture. It was spread out among the various different Christian groups during the early church, so that it was widely accepted. So that's another test. So you have was it written by an apostle during the apostle's time? Was it widely accepted? And the third one, maybe the most important, is orthodoxy. Is it faithful to the teachings of Jesus and the apostles? In other words, when they read these books, are they consistent with what we find in the Gospels and with what the apostles teach? So if you take the time to read some of these other writings that people claim that are out there that are not found in the 66 books of the Bible, you'll find that many of them have some strange ideas, strange teachings, very different than what the apostles and what Jesus taught. And no doubt a lot of that is because of different types of teachings that got incorporated into Christianity early on, and people were trying to write books with claiming a certain amount of authority to try to get the church to accept the ideas that really weren't scriptural. So that's a lot of information. You can read more about it in Blomberg's book. But the point of all of this is to say, when we pick up our Bibles today and we see the 66 books of the Bible, we have to recognize that these writings were incorporated as scripture and were considered authoritative based on some objective standards over time and were accepted very, very early in the time of the church. And that when we see claims of things that are claiming now to say, well, here's a lost book of the Bible, the reality is there really aren't any lost books of the Bible. These books were considered the official collection of inspired books very early on. So if you have any questions about this, feel free to write me. I know, again, it's a lot we covered this week, and I hope you could hang in there with all of that. Thanks again for listening. If you enjoy Footnotes for Faith, please take a second to leave a 5-star rating on whatever platform you listen to the show on, whether it's Apple or Spotify or any other platform. Your feedback helps us reach more people and continue to improve the show. And as always, you can email feedback, questions, or suggestions for future episodes directly to footnotespod@visitdbcc.org. Fisher Media is the producer of Footnotes for Faith. Thanks again for listening. I hope you have a great rest of your day and rest of your weekend, and we'll catch you next time.